Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Wednesday, September 10th, and I'm Nat Cardos reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, fire updates on the Blue and Log fires, Earthquake Brace and Bolt grant program opens again for 2025, grant program now extending to rentals, and the Gene Lucas Community Center in Fortuna install new educational signs in collaboration with Cal Poly Humboldt and College of the Redwoods. So stay tuned, those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilcut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection these tribes have to this region.
An update on the Blue Fire and the Log Fire. The Blue Fire is currently at 3,609 acres and is 33% contained with 741 personnel on scene. All evacuation orders have been lifted, though there are still evacuation warnings in place for certain areas. These can be found at protect.genesis.com. That's protect.genasys.com. KMUD News spoke with Ryan Berlin, Fire Information Officer for California Team 1 for the Blue and Log Fires, for more information about the Blue Fire.
So with the moisture that we've received over the last few days, fire intensity has moderated to smoldering. This is giving the firefighters on the ground a little advantage, a big advantage, to get more containment ground directly on the footprint of the Blue Fire. So California and Team 1 will be transitioning tomorrow, and California Incident Management Team 6 will be taking over operations for the fire and logistics. So that's going pretty seamlessly right now. They're shadowing Team 1, and they will assume command of it tomorrow at 7 in the morning.
The Pacific Crest Trail is still closed between the junction with the Kelsey National Recreation Trail and Sayad Valley. Up-to-date information about this can be found at closures.pcta.org. And now, an update on the log fire. The log fire is currently at 1,169 acres and 0% containment, with 44 personnel on scene. The fire saw minimal growth over the last 2 days due to rain showers. Here's Berlin with more information on the log fire.
Again, the moisture that we received over the last few days, which is, I think, just over an inch, maybe an inch on the log fire, has moderated fire activity also. But we still have two wildfire use modules in the area, and they are wrapping the Woolly Creek historic cabins down there and also doing some structure, removing vegetation, digging some line around those cabins in case the fire does decide to wake up later in the week when there is a warming trend predicted to come back into this area.
There are currently no evacuation warnings or orders in place for the log fire. KMUD News will continue to bring updates on fires during this 2025 fire season. On August 20th, the Earthquake Brace and Bolt grant program offered by the California Earthquake Authority opened for applications for the second time this year. This time around, applications are extended to rentals, not just primary residential properties. This second round has now also expanded to include homes in Humboldt County. KMUD News spoke with Janiel Maffei, Chief Mitigation Officer at the California Earthquake Authority, as well as structural engineer managing the Earthquake Brace and Bolt program, for more information about what the program is and what it does for residents.
We have a grant program for homeowners in California who live in older houses, so that's pre-1980, and have a particular kind of earthquake vulnerability, and that's the fact that their house is not properly bolted or braced to the foundation. The Earthquake Brace and Bolt program provides up to $3,000 to homeowners to have a contractor go into that house and put in new anchor bolts and framing clips at the top of these short stud walls that go around the crawl space, and then plywood that goes around the crawl space. And that is a significant increase in the expected performance of the house in an earthquake. You know, we've seen in many, many earthquakes all the way back to 1906, and of course most recently in the Ferndale Humboldt County earthquakes, that these houses come off their foundation. It's really catastrophic, lots of financial damage, family has to move out, and of course all the while still paying that mortgage.
The Brace and Bolt grant program began in 2013 and since then has retrofitted over 33,000 houses. There also is a supplemental grant offered for income qualifying households.
So we started in 2013, and we have now retrofitted over 33,000 houses through Earthquake Brace and Bolt, and are excited to announce a new registration that's open through October 1st. And we have plenty of money left. Would really like to get people to sign up and take a look. And really exciting that we have a supplemental grant on top of that $3,000 for income-qualifying households. So households where their household income is $89,040 or less can qualify for additional funding above that $3,000.
This is the first year that the California Earthquake Authority has offered this grant program twice in 1 year. Funding this grant program are FEMA funds that have been given to the authority, and the second round is opening because there are still funds left over from the first one. Maffei explains more how this works.
This is maybe the first time we've opened twice in a year, and we just had really good response at the beginning of the year. We've got money left. We are utilizing FEMA grant funds for this program, and we've got money left, and we don't want to leave any of that on the table. So we've opened our second registration. What we do is we have people register, and then when we close registration, we do what's called a kind of a numerical random selection and just basically start letting people out in tranches or in groups. We don't want to overwhelm building departments or the contractors. And so will people know by email that they're either accepted into the program or they're on the waiting list. We don't want anyone to wait if they'd like to proceed with a retrofit, but we don't want them to be discouraged if they're put on our waiting list as well. We just do that so that we don't, as I said, overwhelm the system.
There are certain requirements that applicants must meet to get these grants. The primary one is that the home must have a particular kind of earthquake vulnerability, such as the home not being properly bolted or braced to the foundation. Maffei expands on what these requirements are in further detail.
So most importantly, the house has to have this particular kind of vulnerability. I always say if you have a pre-1980 house, you might have this vulnerability. If you have a pre-1940 house, you do have this vulnerability. And homeowners can go out, look at their house. Maybe you've got 3, 4, 5 steps up to that first floor. You could see either vent holes around in your crawl space. There's typically going to be an access door, either on the outside or in a closet. Of course, the Pier and Post house up in Humboldt County is definitely a candidate for this kind of work. Unfortunately, that house does need to put in a new foundation, so it's more expensive. But this is a classic retrofit solution. Contractors can do it in about 2 to 3 days, and we've got lots of information on our website, pictures, videos, animations, and the actual construction drawings that'll show people just exactly what we want them to do. So very excited to be able to include rentals. In the past, we were owner-occupied with a requirement. Now it's open to rentals. Really an opportunity to just make this much more equitable across the board. We really hope that house owners who have rentals understand the importance of retrofitting, not only to protect the occupants, but to protect really a tremendous investment. For people who live in their home and only own one home, it's the single most expensive investment they'll probably make in their life. If people are relying on these kinds of homes with renters in them, particularly for perhaps when they retire, for income, we want them to know that this is extremely important to protect that investment and, of course, to protect those occupants.
To find out if your home is eligible for the Brace and Bolt grant program, the website is crmp.org under the Seismic Retrofit Program tab. This program is not first come, first serve, though the last day to apply is October 1st. On September 4th, the Gene Lucas Community Center, GLC, in Fortuna unveiled 3 new educational signs along their wetlands walking trails in collaboration with Cal Poly Humboldt and College of the Redwoods students. The Gene Lucas Center is a community center that was opened in 2019 on a 28-acre campus in Fortuna. This space features classrooms, a commercial kitchen, rental halls, as well as a 1-mile walking trail with ADA-accessible portions. KMA News spoke with Lauren Carell, Director of Operations for ERV Community Center Foundation, which runs the GLC, for more about the background of the center.
So yes, so our center, we built in about 2000. It serves the Eel River Valley and really actually beyond. We have a lot of different tenants in our space. We have about 5 different nonprofits that run their own programs out of their specific space. We also do a lot of community partnerships with other nonprofits that utilize our space, not necessarily on a regular basis, probably over 100 different nonprofits. And then we also have our programs that we run. Our biggest one is our First 5 playgroup that runs 3 days a week out of our center for free for anybody that has children 0 to 5. And then we're actually just starting up. We've been doing a lot of cooking programs, little one-offers here and there. We actually just had a tortilla making class. And then we really want to start our program. It's called Ollie's Kitchen. It's going to be a kids cooking program, and that's going to be an ongoing one. And then we also have, of course, our walking trails that are free and open to the public for anybody to use. They're about 1.5 miles that go around our wetland ponds.
talks about creating educational signs for the walking trail started years prior, though the collaboration with Cal Poly and CR students began last year in 2024. The GLC worked with the students through College Corps internships and through a class offered at Cal Poly. Carell elaborates more on this collaboration.
So our center is built on wetlands that have been remade, basically. And so when the center was built, we put in about a mile and a half of walking trails. And throughout probably the last couple years, there's been a lot of questions from community members regarding the ponds, regarding animals, regarding the plant life and different things like that around it. So what we really wanted to do was give people the opportunity to learn more about our site and about the walking trails and why the ponds are there to begin with and how our whole campus runs, how the water flows and different stuff like that, and how it supports the environment. We collaborated with both. There's a specific class at Cal Poly that does interpretive signs. And then we also work with one of our interns. She was through College of the Redwoods, the College Corps program. So we worked with four students and their teacher. It was really amazing because there's actually one of the students did original artwork on the sign. So it's not just signage. It's really cool interpretive signage.
These first three signs are supposed to be the first of 12 that will be installed around the walking trails. The GLC is still looking for funding to support the design and installation of the remaining 9 signs.
Well, funding, of course, like anybody who works in the nonprofit world, it's ultimately the funding. We are hoping to work again with the Cal Poly class. It obviously will be different students, but then again, that's based upon availability. But yeah, signs there, it's not necessarily the cost of the actual sign, but to design it and to make sure that it's accessible to people, that the writing is legible and that all the different colors and stuff mesh with each other. But yeah, we have different fundraisers that we'll raise and grants that we'll write, and hopefully along the way we'll get it all done.
For more information about the GLC and their events, the website is glccenter.org, or you can call the center at 707-725-3300. In state news, legislature passes measure to warn parents when schools are targeted by immigration enforcement, KPFA's Anthony Peraza reports.
Introduced by California Senator Sasha Renee Perez, SB 98 outlines additional steps for schools to take in notifying students' parents and guardians in the event their school is targeted by immigration enforcement. California Assemblymember and Democrat Al Muratsuchi of L.A. emphasizes the importance for children to feel safe in school and says supporting them should be a bipartisan effort.
Students cannot learn unless they feel safe. And we, you know, for decades we had a bipartisan agreement to keep educational institutions, schools, campuses free from immigration enforcement activities. Unfortunately, that decades-long bipartisan agreement was changed in January of this year when the Trump administration started sending ICE agents into our schools. Our communities need to know what is happening at our schools to protect themselves.
California Assemblymember Anna Marie Avila Farias talks about the attacks against immigrant communities and the negative impact on students and families.
This bill is part of a package of bills that help support our immigrant communities. Our communities have been under attack for months under the federal administration, and this bill will ensure individuals working and learning in public institutions are informed when immigration enforcement activity happens on their campus. For students and families, the presence of immigration enforcement can have a chilling effect.
Last week, the family of a teenager who was held at gunpoint by immigration agents outside a high school sued the Trump administration. Teachers, students, and immigrant rights advocates rallied outside the Los Angeles Unified School District last month to protest the detention of Benjamin Marcelo Guerrero Cruz. Lizette Becerra was his teacher when he first arrived from Chile 2 years ago.
He is in detention. He should be in a classroom with us. He does not need to be in detention. Our students need to be safe. All our students deserve the right, they have the right to a free and fair education regardless of their immigration status.
Becerra says she visited him at the Adelanto facility where he was forced to sleep on the floor near a toilet. He told her ICE agents surrounded him looking for a different person as he was out walking his dog. After they took him into custody, he overheard agents gloating of how they were going to make $1,500 for his capture. ICE said it was targeting a relative who was a gang member, which the family disputes. The suit says he was racially profiled and has no relation to the wanted person who was later arrested. For KPFA News, I'm Anthony Perrazzo.
California works to guarantee access as mifepristone turns 25. Public News Service's Suzanne Potter reports.
The abortion medication mifepristone turns 25 this month, but it is under fire in the courts and in multiple red state legislatures. The Food and Drug Administration recently announced a review of the medication. Last year, the U.S. Supreme Court dismissed a lawsuit that would have revoked FDA approval and made the drug illegal nationwide. Now the states of Florida and Texas are trying to revive that plan. UC San Francisco professor Ushma Upadhyay, an expert on telehealth abortion, says there's no merit to the suit.
The science is clear. Mifepristone is safe and effective. Mifepristone was first approved by the FDA 25 years ago. Its safety record has been demonstrated through real-world use and in over 100 research publications.
Anti-abortion groups often oppose its use on religious grounds. Texas now allows people to sue anyone who distributes abortion medication or sends it by mail into the state. But the state of California is among those stockpiling mifepristone and offers resources at abortion.ca.gov. The state passed a SHIELD law in 2023 to protect providers from out-of-state prosecutions. Jennifer Driver is Senior Director of Reproductive Rights with the State Innovation Exchange.
Anti-abortion lawmakers in at least 14 states are escalating their attacks by introducing bills that would criminalize the purchase, prescription, and distribution of medication abortion. And let's be very clear, they're trying to turn doctors into criminals and patients into targets.
Data show that as of last year, one in four abortions was provided through telehealth, compared to 5% before the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022. After that decision, dozens of states passed full or partial abortion bans. Since then, abortion rates have remained steady nationwide. Providers in states with SHIELD laws wrote prescriptions for more than 120,000 medication abortions in 2024. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Bay Area Kaiser workers join strike for labor agreement, protesting unsafe staffing, burnout, patient care. KPFA's Sophia Reis Elfeni reports.
Hundreds of Kaiser healthcare workers are now on strike in the Bay Area, joining over 600 midwives and anesthetists from 20 Northern California Kaiser Permanente hospitals in protest of what they say is Kaiser's failure to settle a fair contract that addresses unsafe staffing, burnout, and the risk to patient care. Midwives and nurse anesthetists have been in contract talks for over a year after working to secure their first union labor agreement since joining the United Nurses Associations of California in 2023. Emily Hardy is a certified nurse midwife at Kaiser Redwood City and also part of the midwife bargaining team.
We have asked for pay that respects our profession and our expertise. Currently, we are paid less than other advanced practice providers, and Kaiser has not met us anywhere near that. They've also not committed to nurse midwifery access. And we're here today to show that our voices matter, midwifery care matters.
Hardy stated that when midwives are involved in patient care, there are lower rates of premature births, cesarean sections, and patient complications.
To not have us means to increase healthcare costs and to decrease maternal child health outcomes for our members.
Kaiser called the strike disappointing and noted that there are bargaining sessions set for later this month. But advocates say they hope the strike will prompt Kaiser leadership to take a closer look at workers' concerns, as they believe the latest proposal does not fully address the scope of the issues. After almost 18 months of negotiations, Kaiser offered workers a 2% hourly pay raise, but simultaneously made substantial cuts to benefits. Sana Jacobson is a certified nurse anesthetist at Kaiser Oakland in Richmond, as well as a member of the union's bargaining team.
It's in terms of 401k pension, so those were reduced. They reduced our options of health care. They increased our co-pays. They reduced our time off. All of those things were substantial cuts to our benefits. And the pay raise of being 1 to 2% when our wages are about 20% below other employers in the region is a real problem.
Kaiser's proposal comes during an ongoing staffing crisis across their facilities, and even some hospitals, like their Santa Clara Medical Center, are closing operating rooms and reducing hours because of anesthesia staffing shortages. Nurse anesthetists constitute half of anesthesia providers within Kaiser and are critical in maintaining access to the operating room.
So for Kaiser to give us that kind of contract, it's just going to exacerbate the problem, and it's going to reduce access to care for Kaiser's patients.
Union members say Kaiser's low wages force midwives and nurse anesthetists to quit, leaving facilities dangerously understaffed and putting patient care at risk. They say competitive wages are needed to retain and attract the best quality talent to adequately staff Kaiser's operating rooms, which ultimately benefits patients. Hardy and Jacobson both say their departments have a hard time attracting new hires because of their low wages that cannot sustain the Bay Area's high cost of living.
We are the ones who are chiefly responsible for patients' safety and comfort within the most vulnerable hours of their lives while they're under anesthesia and undergoing surgery. And it's a workforce that you don't want overworked, that you don't want burnout, that you don't want to have high turnover in. Is that patients are safest when they have a stable, when Kaiser has a stable and adequate anesthesia staff.
The rally is set to end at 7 p.m. tonight. With negotiations scheduled for later this month, both sides face growing pressure to find a compromise before the care they're both trying to safeguard affects the patients who rely on it. This is Sophia Raiselfeni for Pacifica Evening News, KPFA.
In National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A big win for a First Nation in Ontario. The Supreme Court of Canada has dismissed a request from the town of South Bruce Peninsula to appeal a lower court decision that granted a valuable section of beach to the Saugeen First Nation. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the chief of the band calls the ruling like a breath of fresh air.
In April of 2023, the Ontario Appeal Court granted the First Nation ownership of just over a mile of sandy beach in the town of Sauble Beach. It's been a long fight. The case was brought before the courts 35 years ago, but that came nearly 100 years since Indigenous leaders claimed that a treaty in 1854 gave them ownership of the disputed shoreline. Conrad Ritchie is the chief of the Saugeen First Nation.
That's how resilient and patient our people have been to feel finally heard and seen and validated. You're holding your breath for such a long time, and it's like once you get the news, it's just like a breath of fresh air.
With the ruling to appeal now denied by the Supreme Court, the town of South Bruce Peninsula and several landowners appear to have exhausted all legal avenues to retain ownership. On Canada Day, the name of the beach was officially changed from Sauble Beach to Saugeen Beach by the First Nation. Here again, Chief Ritchie.
It kind of grooms society. It kind of grooms community. It kind of grooms children when you have a colonial name that's supposed to be the Indigenous people of that land's land and beach.
Now that the legal wrangling over ownership of the land has been decided, the next step is to discuss compensation with the federal government for breaking that 1854 treaty. Meanwhile, Ritchie says Saugeen Beach will continue to be open to the public as a tourist destination. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
This past weekend, roughly 10,000 people converged on Bismarck, North Dakota to drum, dance, and celebrate one of the region's oldest powwows. Senior reporter Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire has the story.
It's going to be a good day here at the United Tribes Technical College International Powwow.
The 55th United Tribes Technical College International Powwow started modestly in 1970. A small group of students held it on a tennis court. But in the years since, it's exploded in scale and magnitude, drawing participants and visitors from all over, including Europe. UTTC President Leander McDonald says it's not only a cultural event, but a huge economic boost to the Bismarck area when combined with several other events like their sports tournaments.
And a previous study indicated $4.2 million for that week. Did another analysis, but we felt it was kind of off a little bit because they told us a million. And so now we're working with the Bismarck Band and Chamber here, and they have some folks that do analysis on just events on their own.
Historically, the UTTC International Powwow was also once the last call before winter, before indoor powwows and those in warmer climes took off. This year's event was covered live by Buffalo's Fire and Prairie Public, a statewide public media broadcast organization. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull in Bismarck.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Larry Lashley, and thanks to our reporters, Anthony Perrazzo, Suzanne Potter, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMUD News is online, and you can find us on kmud.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Are you passionate about your community? Looking to report on what's happening around Mendocino? KMUD News is looking for stringer reporters from the Mendocino area to cover local Mendocino stories that matter. Whether you're a seasoned journalist or just eager to learn, we'll help you get started. You'll get training, support, and a chance to amplify real voices from your community. If you're interested, email news@kmud.org for more information. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Nat Cardos.